This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. There may be no topic people want to shy away from talking about more than suicide, the paradox being that efforts to prevent it demand that such conversations happen. This is National Suicide Prevention Week, and the issue is of particular importance in Vermont, a state that has a rate of people taking their own lives that's higher than the national average. Numbers can only outline the problem, yet certain statistics are alarming, including the fact that in Vermont, more people die by suicide than from motor vehicle accidents, homicide, and drowning combined. For anyone who's lost someone to suicide, though, numbers do nothing to approach the pain and sorrow left behind, and questions about how the self-inflicted loss of life could have been prevented. Our guests today want you to know that getting the conversation about suicide out from the shadows and implementing new collaborative strategies to recognize and prevent it from happening can and will make a life-saving difference. Joining us from our studios in Brattleboro is Joellen Torello, Executive Director of the Center for Health and Learning in Brattleboro. And thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome, and thank you for focusing the spotlight on this important issue.
We also have on the line with us today psychologist Dr. Stephen Brower, Director of Behavior Health at Northwestern Counseling Support and Services in St. Albans. And welcome to you, Dr. Brower.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we want you to join the conversation as well. You can call us at 800-639-2211 or post on our Vermont Edition Facebook page or write to us an email, vermontedition@vpr.net. Joellen Torello, I'd like to start with you. As I've mentioned, this is National Suicide Prevention Week, and tomorrow is National Suicide Prevention Day. What does that actually mean, though, beyond what someone may see on Twitter on a hashtag, for example? What's been happening nationally this week that may have been part of the Vermont effort as well?
There's a lot of emphasis on creating a dialogue about suicide, certainly raising people's awareness about suicide as a preventable public health issue, a national issue, as well as a state and local issue. I think the prevailing message we want to get across is that suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility, whether we are talking and looking at it at an individual level, our relationships with our friends, neighbors, family members. We can take action, but also that it's our responsibility on an organizational and systems level, thinking about the policies and the programs and the strategies we use within organizations to promote suicide-safe environments.
You head up an organization called the Center for Health and Learning. What does your group do to help prevent suicides in the state?
The Center for Health and Learning at large is a comprehensive health organization. We're concerned about critical health issues, priority health issues that particularly impact people's educational outcomes. It's said that the best strategy for public health is for students to graduate with a high school education. So we were originated actually by the Vermont Agency of Education to promote the connection between health outcomes and academic learning outcomes. That said, we were designated as the lead agency by the Department of Mental Health some years back to receive a organize and receive a federal grant called the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Funding focused on youth suicide prevention. That has now expanded to suicide prevention across the lifespan, and we created the Vermont Suicide Prevention Center as a program of the Center for Health and Learning to bring attention to that issue.
Dr. Stephen Brower, let's turn to you now. Behavior Health at Northwestern Counseling Support offers a number of services. How does the work that you do fit into efforts to prevent suicide?
Well, I think we're one of 10 designated public mental health agencies, and we've been working closely with the Center for Health and Learning and the Department of Mental Health to look at what are things that we can do. I mean, the sad reality, not just in Vermont but also across the country, is most individuals who die by suicide aren't even in treatment, and we know that stigma is one of the barriers to that. So that's part of one of the goals is how do we create broader community awareness, but then also how do we look at ourselves and our own practices, and are there things that we can be doing in terms of more effective treatment and outreach with other provider systems.
As a psychologist, what are some of the classic warning signs and maybe some others that slip under the radar that may indicate that a person is serious about taking their own life?
pressure? Well, some are typically that the person is actually talking about killing themselves. That is something as a flag, the fact that someone's threatening to say something. And to feel comfortable as a friend or a peer or as an employee to be able to have a dialogue about that is essential. Seeking access to means to actually that the person is actually taking some efforts to do something. Talking or writing about death or dying or suicide. Feelings of hopelessness. Feelings of agitation is actually one of the ones that oftentimes we can all be agitated for different reasons, but that combined with a variety of other risks in somebody's life or stressors can actually be something to be very concerned about.
I'd like you to elaborate a little more on that because you are a trained psychologist. You're trained to see such things, and I wonder what people who don't have your kind of training can do to recognize these signs. And when you talk about things like agitation, as you said, everybody gets agitated at some point. What does that agitation look like to you, and can a layman look at that and see the same things that could be a real warning sign?
Sure. Well, I think particularly if you know somebody, if you're a coworker or a family member, and say, what's the quality of the agitation? So, for example, if my car breaks down this morning and I'm frustrated, that's proportional agitation. But if I seem to always be agitated, and particularly it's affecting my sleep, and I'm also having financial problems, and if you know me, you know there are more things happening in my life where the quality of my agitation indicates that I'm just not problems. I'm not really solving my problems in an effective way and seem pretty constricted in my thought process. Those are always pretty big flags. I mean, obviously, we all experience stress, so there's a difference. There are multiple pathways towards this. But if you particularly work with somebody, I think one of the things we're learning is that people in natural supports in individuals' lives know when something's a little bit different with somebody. And so does the quality of the way this person's relating to you shift? From a clinical point of view, when you're meeting somebody, you're looking at other kinds of risk factors in their lives that are contributing to the agitation.
Joanne Torello, I want to ask about the idea, and you know, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all thing here about suicides. There could be so many factors that go into this. I think sometimes we've heard that suicide can almost be an impulse, that somebody will decide suddenly to take their own lives. Is that a myth? Is that a mythology? Is there some way to tease out whether or not somebody has been thinking about this a long time or if it can happen very quickly?
90% of people who go on to die by suicide, it's estimated, have some kind of identifiable mental health disorder, and depression is the most prevalent mental health disorder. We're pretty good at diagnosing depression, but what we've come to understand through a lot of research over the last 5 and 10 years is that we can identify predisposing mental health factors or conditions like depression or certain mental disorders such as schizophrenia or bipolar, which may put people at increased risk. But what we need to do is be able to identify suicidality directly. As far as impulsivity or problems that may not seem like a big deal to one person may be causing a great deal of distress for the suicidal person. And this is particularly true for youth and young adults. We have to remember that perceived crises are just as concerning to the suicidal person potentially as actual crisis. And therefore, we need to not overlook them, dismiss them, but really respond.
In other words, what may seem like not a very big deal to us, to that person that's going through it, it is a very big deal to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where we're looking for symptoms that not just come and go as you might expect for somebody who's having a bad day, but symptoms that may reoccur almost every day over a period of time, and you start to see that or feel that person is not functioning at their normal level.
We're talking about suicide prevention in Vermont today with two experts in the field. Joellen Torello heads up the Center for Health and Learning in Brattleboro, and psychologist Stephen Brower leads the Behavioral Health Division at Northwestern Counseling Support and Services. That's in St. Albans. Listeners, we would love for you to weigh in as well. What progress do you see Vermont communities making and mental health agencies making to reduce the suicide rate in the state? What do you think of the efforts to reframe suicide as a public health issue rather than an act of private shame? You can call us at 800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net. And one of the reasons I asked about the impulsivity, Joanne Torello, is because one of the more alarming facts about how suicides occur in Vermont is that between 2009 and 2015, 59% of Vermont suicide deaths involved firearms, while in the rest of the northeastern U.S., that compares with only 36% of suicide deaths occurring due to the use of a firearm. What can you tell us about the Gunshot Project that hopes to reduce the use of firearms and suicides?
Well, the Gunshot Project is a statewide suicide awareness and prevention partnership between the Vermont Department of Mental Health, the Vermont Suicide Prevention Coalition and Center, and the leading organizations in the firearm owner, gun owners community, the Vermont Federation of Sportsmen's Clubs and the Gun Owners of Vermont.
Has it been difficult to keep the gun control debate from getting into these efforts? Because some advocates of gun control say that the rate of suicides via firearms is very much one of the arguments they make that stricter gun control laws should be on the books.
You know, we have all, I think, been able to manage very well by keeping a focus on our collaborative effort, which is to prevent suicide. The Gunshot Project is based on the New Hampshire's model, which is now spreading to numerous other states, including Tennessee and Colorado. And what it focuses on is raising public awareness, disseminating public awareness material, in particular to gun shops and ranges, through posters, tip sheets, risk factors, and getting out messages about the awareness of warning signs of suicide, encouraging those in the gun-owning community to reach out to each other when troubled, and the emphasis that a fellow gun owner has the best chance of helping a gun owner in crisis as a trusted peer, a person who understands the importance of guns in another person's life. And so we've really focused on the peer support piece, and that's very much been the collaborative spirit between the state agency and the gun owner associations in Vermont.
I would imagine this also includes things like if you do own guns, keeping them locked up. If you have children or teenagers in the house, that you should make sure that those guns are kept safely locked and stowed away.
Yeah, restricting access to lethal means when somebody is in a suicidal crisis is absolutely critical, regardless of the means. And that is very true for safe storage of guns, removal when a person is at risk, talking with that person, developing a collaborative approach to ensuring their safety, expressing concern and the reasons for suggesting the removal of firearms. And that is also true for drugs, prescriptive drugs, and other tools that may be available to somebody.
You mentioned New Hampshire. Vermont does have two gun owners workshops coming up that are by gun owners for gun owners to teach about suicide prevention. And you can find that information on our website at vpr.net, along with many other resources as well that we'll be talking about throughout the show today. Let's go to the phones right now. Peter is on the line from Hinesburg. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Mitch. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So, of course, suicide is extremely hard to talk about. Nobody likes to talk about it, but a very poignant issue. A lot of times there are no signs, and families of the victims will say, oh, you know, they never showed any signs of depression or anything like that. I would have never expected them to do this, you know? So I think we need to be more open to depression, and we need to work on bullying and stuff in schools, and we need to make therapy more accessible and less expensive. You know, not everybody has insurance, or insurance needs to accept therapy patients, you know, more.
Peter, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Brower, I'd like you to address some of what Peter is saying there. Are the resources there to get people into the therapy that they need? And is this issue being talked about enough in a frank and open way? Because it is difficult to talk about.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest barriers is stigma, that it's the idea of getting help for a mental health condition is still frowned upon. I think you see a little bit of a difference between different groups of people more open to it than not. There also is a reality of, you know, with changing healthcare, you know, these high deductible plans. We know we have programs where we have grants, let's say in primary care, and we have, you know, family members saying, we're trying to make a specialized referral, and they'll say, you know, I'd rather see you here in the primary care setting because I can't afford my high deductible, when we know they really need a higher level of care than we can provide in that setting. So there are definite barriers to it. I think there's been some, particularly since Hurricane Irene in 2011 when the flood happened and it flooded out the state hospital, one of the things that's been a positive development in the the designated mental health system with is with Act 79. Most designated mental health agencies now have mobile outreach, and we're able to outreach and do things that we've never been able to do before and engage individuals who really are challenged by wanting to get help, and I think that's a good thing. But that's, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis. I can't say it's totally systematic.
I would imagine that one of the more frustrating parts of your work, both of you, in this area is the well-worn statement by some that for some people who want to end their lives, that step is inevitable, that they will find a way to do it no matter the efforts of people in your field to prevent it from happening. Joellen Torello, how do you address that kind of mythology, if you will, that surrounds suicide?
Well, actually, the research shows that there was a very good study that shows that 90% of those people who had an attempt went on and were able to recover. So that is a myth that we're trying to talk openly about. But I think going back to one of the thoughts I had responding to Peter's question is that if you don't ask, First of all, when it comes to teenagers and young adults, we know that 4 out of 5 times they are going to say something to a peer and not to an adult. Very often people have said or done, when thinking back, they have shown signs. So it's really critical that we tune in and become very aware of what it is we're looking for in a sense over time. But also that we feel comfortable asking the question, because if we don't ask, it can go not undiagnosed. And that is the premise of the Zero Suicide Initiative in Vermont.
I want to get to that in just a moment. But to your point, Joellen, that you just made here, we got this message from Susan, who writes, "On this day in 1990, my brother killed himself by overdosing on his own antidepressants, which he had stockpiled for several months. One thing to be aware of," she writes, "is that a friend, sibling, spouse, etc., are they taking the meds that were prescribed? Mark went to all his appointments and seemed, quote, fine, but sadly, he had been making the plan to kill himself all along." So I think that does point to the fact that you really need to watch what's happening with your loved ones, with your friends, and in situations where there are potential, medications that could kill, that has to be watched very closely.
That's right.
The Vermont Department of Health, as you mentioned, is launching a project called Zero Suicide. It's a framework that promotes the goal of no suicides among people who are under care in health systems. I think that's an important point. Dr. Bauer, your organization is part of this effort. Is a zero suicide rate for people under the healthcare system actually achievable, in your view?
Well, it actually was achieved, I guess, and Joellen can speak. I think it was the Henry Ford Health Foundation had done this in another state and in a closed health system where they actually were able to achieve it. I think it's provocative and it's challenging, and I think it's a great goal to have. We know that there are many barriers to it, but the primary focus of the model is really looking at your system across, even particularly for us in our region. We're looking at our system, we're looking at primary care. How are we screening and assessing? What are the pathways to care? When someone goes from the emergency department to our crisis bed or what have you, how are they being followed? What is our treatment? Are we looking at more effective treatments? Is there really a leadership commitment to improving our treatment options and our workflows? These are key things that we're looking at. Both the Howard Center and our agency are looking at in partnership with our other agencies. And I think it's really important. Important work. I think the hard part for us is that we can always improve our systems. There's no question about it. The hard part for me, I know, and others, is that we keep hearing about individuals that we do not even know who are dying in our communities.
Hmm. Joellen, I have to ask, though, is there some risk in a zero suicide goal of demoralization if it's not successful? And I'm thinking a lot about loved ones who are left behind that may feel tremendous guilt at not having been able to prevent a suicide. Is the bar, in essence, being set too high with zero suicide?
We work with a lot of survivors in the Vermont Suicide Prevention Coalition, and I think everybody agrees that it's potentially achievable, but it's certainly aspirational. Just last night I read the heartbreaking Facebook entry of a friend, a Vermont mother who lost her daughter to suicide 5 years ago, and her daughter would have been 21. And she just implored anyone suffering from suicidal thoughts to reach out and get help. And so I think that between recognizing that we would not overlook somebody who was having a cardiac crisis without making sure that we were detecting what the problem was And in order to do that, we have to know and understand the problem. We have to have healthcare systems that are ready to respond, just like we have coronary care units ready to respond. That's the focus of Zero Suicide. It's creating a pathway to care in healthcare systems that can effectively screen, ask whether somebody is thinking on every intake, and that's what the Henry Ford healthcare system did. And then if they assessed as potentially positive on that screen that there was a risk, they were immediately assessed at a higher level and then put into a pathway of care that ensured that they were not going to be left alone, so to speak, on this journey, but that they were going to get effective treatment and there was going to be follow through at every patient crisis or every patient point of contact to ensure that that person was seen through to the place where they were out of crisis and ideally towards recovery.
We have this question from Brett, who wants to know, is there an elevated level of suicide among males in Vermont in the 25 to 35 year age range? What is a particular cause in these cases, if that's the case?
Want me to take that
one? Yeah, go ahead, Joanne.
So. Sure. So actually, the highest demographic for suicide is males in the middle-aged group between 45 and 60, 65. The age group he's asking about is heading towards that middle-aged time. And I think it has a lot to do with stress, perception of stress, financial crisis, economic pressures, stereotypical pressures on males that they are the providers, and when they find pressure in the workplace, lose a job, and feel that they cannot live up to some of the expectations, they succumb. And so I think that those are the prevailing current understandings.
We're going to go to the phones now. We have Sue on the line from Richmond. Hi, Sue. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. I'm actually just calling in because my son attempted suicide earlier this year. And I'm calling in because, as we're saying, I really feel that Vermont needs to spend more money treating this like a healthcare crisis. He spent four nights in an ER without getting any sleep or treatment before a bed became available. And the sad truth is, especially for kids, there's only one treatment center that they can go to. So I really just feel that the state of Vermont needs to work on, one, how to treat patients while they're waiting in the ER, and two, just to get more facilities set up. This is a growing crisis, and families are really trying to advocate, and I was exhausted, and I know how to advocate for my child, but the state of Vermont really needs to start backing up a lot of these families, whether they're children or adults.
Sue, is your son getting the care that he needs now?
He is, but it's taken a lot of fighting and a lot of sleepless nights.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your call. I really appreciate that, Sue. Dr. Brower, I'd like you to follow up on that a little bit. I mean, that story that Sue just told, is that something that you hear that sounds familiar to you?
Absolutely. I think she makes a good point. It's not just kids, it's adults as well. I mean, one of the nice things about Vermont is we've made a real commitment to a community-based system of care. The challenge is we don't have really a responsive inpatient. You know, we have a joke within our, I mean, it's a thing that we make sense of here. We said it's easier to get into Harvard than it is to get into a hospital sometimes, and it's an unfortunate reality. I think when it comes to acute care, we have to have a system that's more responsive, and I know there are barriers to that, but I was just in a meeting this morning with the community members, and that very theme very much came up about we've been fortunate in our region in the sense that we haven't had a lot of backup, but last week we had two people sitting for over a week waiting for an inpatient bed, and those were adults. They weren't kids. But for children, it is even more challenging because of fewer options.
We have just a couple of minutes left here, and I want to ask this last question to both of you, put it to both of you. Intervention, I would imagine, has got to be one of the most difficult parts of this problem. When to get involved, how insistently, what message do you have for people who may suspect that a friend or loved one is considering taking their own life? Should they talk to that person first? Consult a mental health professional before intervening? What is the best way to go about it? Let's start with you, Joanne.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. It's incumbent upon each of us to be observant and to really listen to that little voice inside us that's telling us something isn't right here, and to respond, to let that person know, I care about you. I love you. You're saying, you know, these things. I see you doing these things. They're concerning, and I'm going to help get help. Here are some of the sources of help. What's going to work best? And remain vigilant.
Dr. Brower, last word to you. What is the best way to go about this if you really suspect someone is willing to take that last step?
I mean, I think connection, we know, is the most important thing, that you have a relationship. I think it's important not to feel, you know, intimidated by it. Be real. Just say, listen, I care about you. I can tell you're really struggling with something. It's really important to stay with the person and not leave them alone, particularly if you're concerned about them doing something fairly soon. And be with them through the process. Say, I want to get you the help. And even if we have some barriers, we're not going to give up. We're going to keep trying to get you help.
Okay.
And beyond that, ahead, Steve, we have 211 in Vermont with some trained providers by the National Lifelines. There's the National Lifelines number 1-800-273-TALK and Veterans Crisis Lines 1-800-273-8255.
And Joanne,
call your local mental health agency.
Okay, let me just break in here to mention that we have all those numbers you're talking about, links to other resources as well on our website at vpr.net. We urge you to go there. Details about workshops, suicide prevention events that are happening for gun owners coming soon. You can find all these at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. You'll also find the hotline phone numbers that Joellen was just mentioning and links to resources there if you missed it. We've been speaking with Joellen Torello, Executive Director of the Center for Health and Learning in Brattleboro, and psychologist Dr. Stephen Brower of Northwestern Counseling and Support Services in St. Albans. I want to thank you both so much for your time today and for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you again, Steve, for making this a priority.
Thank you.
And coming up, one investor in the EB-5 program at Jay Peak helped uncover the alleged $200 million fraud there. And just ahead, we'll follow the paper trail of his story. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. This spring, the EB-5 scandal broke open in the Northeast Kingdom, unleashing federal and state allegations that two business partners perpetrated a $200 million fraud. As those civil court cases move forward against Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger, people are still working to understand how the fraud continued over several years. This week, investigative reporter Hillary Niles has been reporting for VPR on one investor who figured out the fraud himself and who says he tried to warn the state about what was happening. Hillary Niles, thank you so much for coming back to Vermont Edition to talk about your reporting.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mitch.
Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger were partners in the Q Burke and Jay Peak ski resorts, and they're accused of defrauding foreign investors who wanted to immigrate to the U.S. under the EB-5 visa program. Remind us first how EB-5 works and what Quiros and Stenger are accused of doing.
Sure. So EB-5 is a federal visa program. It's not just in Vermont. It's a federal program that fast-tracks green cards, which is basically permanent residency, for immigrants who create American jobs by putting at least $500,000 into an American business. So Ariel Quiros is the owner of Jay Peak, and Bill Stenger is, or was, as the case may be, the longtime president and CEO of the resort up in the Northeast Kingdom. They used EB-5 money to pay for the massive build-outs at Jay Peak in recent years, for the new hotel at Burke Mountain that just opened this week, and they were planning to use EB-5 for several other projects that never got off the ground. But what they're accused of doing, that would have all been fine, but what they're accused of doing is misusing that investor money. Allegedly, Stenger transferred the money to Quiros, who then used it for things like paying off the purchase of Jay Peak Resort, for one thing, buying the Burke Mountain ski area for another, paying off taxes, buying a condo in New York. They did use the money for the intended projects as well, but it was allegedly done by pooling the money to get from different projects, and mingling the money in that way really wasn't allowed. So anyway, all of this alleged activity left Jay Peak short on cash to pay back investors when their returns came due, or also we've learned to pay off contractors. For example, up at Burke Mountain, there are contractors still owed millions of dollars up there.
Well, this alleged fraud had a lot of people saying that there were red flags, and people are asking, why didn't anyone do something sooner? Your reporting this week was an example of one EB-5 investor, Tony Sutton, who did piece together suspicions about Jay Peak's construction projects. And who is Tony Sutton?
So Tony Sutton is a car dealer from London. He's one of 35 investors in Jay Peake's very first EB-5 project around 2008, 2009. Those investors put their money into the Tramhouse Lodge. But then in early 2004, they learned that their equity in the Tramhouse had been converted to debt the year before without their knowledge. And what that means is that Kyros and Stanger basically seized ownership of the hotel without telling the investors, and then when they found out, just gave them an IOU instead of giving them their money back. So Tony Sutton is the guy who, when this happened, just didn't let it go. He took it upon himself, this is a very substantial legwork of trying to get to the bottom of it.
So he and these other investors thought they would be owning part of the hotel, and then behind their backs, that turned out not to be the case. The money was converted into debt. Sutton found contact information for other Jay Peake investors in an old email, and over a few months, about 20 of those investors started working together, asking questions about what was going on with their investments. And you reported that at one point they hired a forensic accountant. It was kind of actually a hard copy of financial reports from years earlier that proved to be critical. What did Tony Sutton realize that he already had in his possession?
Yes, so this whole saga is fascinating, but this one detail is really striking. So I'll explain. Tony and the other investors, once they started looking into this, really encountered one obstacle after another. And then in the fall, Tony remembered his green card petition. So the whole point of that petition is proving that the investors' money created jobs, and that's done in the petition by detailing how the money was spent. So we're talking bank statements, invoices, purchase orders, receipts, canceled checks, basically a whole long money trail like that. And it was what Tony needed to investigate his suspicions, which boiled down to the suspicion that the Tramhouse investors were not getting their money back that year because they thought the money had been spent elsewhere. And they just tried to figure out how to prove that or disprove it. They were kind of hoping they wouldn't find anything. Backing up around 2011, when Tony's petition was approved, his immigration attorney had offered to just keep the electronic version on file because apparently, understandably, most people don't really want this paperwork lying around. But Tony, just being kind of the thorough guy that he is, said, no, send me the hard copy. And he had, at the time, no real reason for asking for it because at that time, nothing had gone wrong. But years later, when things had gone very wrong, there it was. And he was very glad that he had it because it made it easier to research. So the conclusions that he reached from studying those documents actually came to be supported in pretty great detail by in-depth investigations at both the state and federal levels. So those investigators with subpoena power were able to amass way more evidence than Tony, you know, had been able to put together. Mm-hmm. And that's what eventually built their cases against the state and federal cases against Kyros and Stanger. So, you know, nobody's saying that Tony's findings were enough to file charges. But it's still interesting that a car dealer arrived at the same essential conclusions, which is commingling that money and unauthorized loans taking out with investor money as collateral. He was able to arrive at those essential conclusions just through sort of his perseverance applied to the limited information that he did have. But here's the most fascinating thing about this to me is that in all likelihood, those documents that comprised his green card petition were provided to Tony's immigration attorney by Jay Peake itself. So this is my understanding of how the petition process works from every immigration attorney I've spoken to, is that the documents come from the developers, which, you know, if the allegations prove true, just kind of makes you wonder what they were thinking.
It's really kind of amazing. He became a detective, really, on his own and got so far with this. By fall of 2014, Sutton took his concerns to the state's EB-5 Regional Center. Describe what that Department of State Government is.
Right. So investors knew that their money was at risk, but many of them found reassurance in the fact that the state government actually runs Vermont's EB-5 program. Almost every other EB-5 project in the country is solely a private affair, but in Vermont, it's run by the regional center's responsibilities are split between the Commerce Agency, which basically handles promotion and logistics, and the Department of Financial Regulation, and they're the ones who actually have legal authority to pursue enforcement. But originally, it was just run by the Commerce Agency, which simply doesn't have all of the legal authority that they would need to really oversee and enforce the program on a regulatory level like they can now. So now that structure is fixed, but it didn't get fixed really until a lot of damage from J-PEEK was done.
Well, the Department of Financial Regulation credits Tony Sutton's letter in fall of 2014 as being pretty key to launching the state's investigation in winter of 2015. But Sutton told you he felt the state was unresponsive to his efforts to expose the fraud going on at J-PEEK. What communication was he having with the regional center or other state officials?
Right. So key may not be exactly the word that the Commissioner of Financial Regulation would use to describe Tony's letter. Michael Pichak says that once his department got put into place for, you know, the regulatory role, he says they would have found everything out even without Tony's documents. I will say, for one thing, it had already come to light that the SEC, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, was already investigating Ariel Quiroz. So that would have helped, for one. But Michael Pichak believes that his office would have found it out anyway. At any rate, Tony, before DFR got involved, Tony first brought his concerns to the Regional Center and the Commerce Agency, and that was in early 2014 when the investors first learned that they had lost ownership of the tram house. So the Regional Center, to be clear, did respond to those early concerns. No one apparently seems to have responded to Tony's letter later that fall. But before that, there's plenty of written correspondence that shows the Regional Center was responsive. To be clear, Tony also found the Regional Center's responses wholly unsatisfying. But the Regional Center believes that record proves their diligence. So there's a real fundamental difference of opinion there.
And Hillary, just a few seconds left here, but where does this leave investors like Tony Sutton now?
Well, they're still wondering if they're going to get their money back, for one thing. They're contemplating legal action of their own. And one addition is that Michael Pichak, the financial regulator, has made it clear his office is continuing its investigation and may even tack on new charges to the lawsuit against Quiroz and Stanger.
Hillary Niles is an independent investigative reporter who's been reporting for VPR about the EB-5 scandal in the Northeast Kingdom. You can read her stories from this week about one British investor who played a role in tipping off state regulators to the alleged $200 million fraud. And Hillary, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Now, if somebody mentions to you Schoolhouse Rock, you could probably sing a few bars of "I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill." I'm not going to do the whole thing, don't worry. Or another classic that used music to teach concepts. Well, coming up, we'll talk with a Brattleboro educator and musician who's taken a similar idea to another level. This is Vermont Edition. It's Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. For most kids in Vermont, school is now back in session, so we finish today's program by going back to the classroom ourselves with Jerry Appel. He's the founder of Rock in the Classroom, and maybe if Jerry was around teaching the members of Pink Floyd when they were kids, the anthem from Another Brick in the Wall that "We Don't Need No Education" would never have been written. That's because a few years ago, Jerry Appel recorded a couple of CDs that taught and engaged high school and college students about subjects like Manifest Destiny, Orwell's Animal Farm, and fractions and decimals through the power of song. Now he's shifted his attention to teaching the teachers, and Jerry joins us now from our Norwich studios. Welcome back to Vermont Edition, Jerry.
Thank you, Mitch. I'm glad to be here.
You're doing workshops for teachers. What is it that you're getting them to learn?
Well, I just want to kind of start off by complimenting you on remembering "I'm Just a Bill."
Oh, it's one of my favorites.
And you did a good job.
Thank you very much.
And it's kind of it's kind of the basis of what we're doing. And the idea is that, you know, you remember that song, and I don't know how long, and you don't have to tell me how long ago it was that you first heard it, but it's interesting how that song will stay in your mind all these years and all the ideas that it's based on, and the worksheet that you might have been doing that year about how a bill is made, you might forget the minute you get out the classroom door. And so what I'm trying to do in these workshops is take that process, bring it to teachers. And this is something a lot of teachers already know because, you know, we all remember songs from our youth and they stay in our minds. But somehow we often take the more conventional assignments seriously. And so in our workshop, what I do is try to find out the ways that teachers are using music and art to improve instruction. And we end up writing songs in the workshop as a role model for things that students can do back in the classroom.
You know, I think about a current example, like the show Hamilton, which is so popular. And because the songs are so compelling, people are learning about the life of Alexander Hamilton like they never have before. Is that one fair example?
That's a great example. And I just, you know, like everybody else, I've been fascinated by that show. And it kind of validates what we're doing in our work. Because there's probably a large number of people that wouldn't take the time to read about Alexander Hamilton. But now, because of the show, they sort of do a backwards process and go into literature and books, history books about Hamilton.
The thing is, though, you have to get it right, too. I mean, you can't just rhyme, you know, one word with another because it works. You've got to make sure that the history is accurate as well. I wonder if there are some subjects that are more adaptable to this approach than others.
Well, at first, my background is in social studies, so my assumption was always that social studies was very easy. But what I've been doing in the last few years is I've been going to conferences, state and some national conferences of specific subjects. And the subject I thought would be the hardest was science in some ways, because it tends to be a more serious type of classification systems.
Mm-hmm.
And those science conferences I seem to have the most fun at.
Really?
They come up with some great songs.
Well, I'll tell you another subject that some of us find intimidating, not everyone, but math would be one of them. And I hate to put you on the spot here, Jerry, but I could use some improvement in my math skills. Could you sing a song that would help me?
Well, let's see. I did have, I came with some science songs, but let me see if I can remember a math song. The one we did called Fractions and Decimals. Let me see. This goes, a fraction and a decimal in love. Who can know the terms they're dreaming of? Denominator finds the algorithm. And let me see. I can't remember the rest of that particular
song. Give me
song,
a science one then, because I love that one already.
Okay, science one just doing is one I have head. With me.
Yeah.
So we had a science. This came out of a workshop where we came up with a cowboy song about chromosomes. And so you try to set in your mind a background, sort of one of those Riding on the Range songs. So this one goes, 46 chromosomes went riding out one day to try to make a brand new human being. And the weapon they carried in their genes was the chemical they call DNA. Yippee-yi, yippee-hey. Cowboy chromosomes are shooting DNA. Hey, yippee-yi, yippee-yay. It's the chemical they call DNA. Let me do another verse on that one.
Please.
A chromosome with a domineering gene will give you a patch of freckles on your skin. And if you find that you're losing all your hair, a recessive gene has shot you fair and square. Yippee-yi, yippee-yi, yippee-yay. Yip, two voices here. Yippee-yay. Cowboy chromosome shooting DNA. Hey, yippee-yi, yippee-yay. It's the chemical they call DNA.
Yeah.
You know, acapella, okay? So.
Absolutely. You know, Jerry, you've got some pretty good pipes. Does this work whether you can sing well or not?
Yeah. And I don't know about... suffering from a little bit of laryngitis because I just did a workshop yesterday. But yeah, you know, what we do in a workshop, if I can just run through that really quickly,
sure. Is
let's say I have 15 or 20 teachers in the group, and let's say it's a math conference, and I try to find teachers that have a similar age level or, you know, similar subject, whether it's algebra or geometry. They get into small groups of three or four, so that's your songwriting team. And to make it easy and to make it quick, they just do a song parody, piggyback song, setting it to a song that everybody knows. So the first thing they do is they will come up with key terms that should be in the song, and they piece that together, and then we put it on large Post-it paper, and everybody gathers around each song that we post on the wall, and we sing them together a cappella, and then we talk about what each member of the group did to contribute to the completion of the song.
Wow, that's fantastic. We've got about 20, 30 seconds here. Can you give me something on history?
Yeah.
Let me see here.
I mean, if you can't do science again, I just want to hear you sing, Jerry. That's
okay,
what
well, let's do
to.
Animal Farm, because we do literature as well. And I brought a couple of songs.
I love that
out
book.
With me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what this is just a narrative of the story. Have you been to the Manor Farm since the world turned upside down? Farmer Jones has gone away. The animals finally have a say. Since the revolution, they have equality, changing the nature of their society. And then we have a final verse. I won't go through the whole song. In the end, it's all the same. The farm resumes its former name. Remembering what once was true is nothing more than deja vu. So long to utopia and our democratic dreams. Today, the pigs are acting just like human beings. And that particular number, that particular song goes through the entire, it's like an 8-verse song that goes through the...
I almost added my own line.
What's
just,
that?
Just remember to be glad, 4 legs good and 2 legs bad.
Right. And didn't that come from the novel?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm
that's
saying,
great.
You know. All right. We got to go, Jerry. Thank you so much.
Mitch,
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on again.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And coming up on Monday, Vermont is a pretty dog-friendly state, but that can come with some issues. On Vermont Edition, dogs out in the world, training etiquette, where your pup should and shouldn't go, and managing interactions with other people and their pets. Send your questions and comments to us at VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen live Monday at noon. I'm Mitch Wertley. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much for listening.